Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping the future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching us later, stay ahead with the stories that matter. Coming up on the program, the Democratic Alliance calls for no tax increases and what it terms a real commitment to structural reform in the finance minister's upcoming budget speech. The tourism sector says it'll need big actions from the minister to help the industry flourish. A look at what it might cost you for your solar system to be compliant with Eskom's proposed new rules, and why an expert says companies shouldn't get swept up in the tech hype at the real cost of return on investment. It's Tuesday, the 18th of February. Now, South Africa approaches the 2025 budget speech tomorrow. The nation is facing critical economic challenges, including sluggish growth, a mounting debt burden, and a cost of living crisis. And all of this affects millions. The Democratic Alliance, part of the Government of National Unity, has outlined its expectations for the upcoming budget, emphasizing a need for infrastructure investment, policy reform to stimulate private sector job growth, and a firm stance against new tax increases. I want to delve a little deeper into these proposals. Dr. Mark Burke is with us, the spokesman for the party on finance. Dr. Burke, the Democratic Alliance, and good afternoon to you, expressing strong opposition to any new tax increases in tomorrow's budget. It seems, though, this might be inevitable given the very large revenue shortfall.
We don't think it's inevitable. We will oppose it by any means at our disposal. It is completely unfathomable at this point that we would burden South African taxpayers even further. There's a range of measures that need to be put in place as part of this budget process, but it's also not without outside the realm of possibility that we could look at spending cuts. We've been asking for spending review for more than 4 years now, and strategically asking for it at least for the last half a year. So there are things we can do that doesn't involve taxing the South African citizen anymore.
And let's get to that in just a moment. But let's assume there was, for instance, a move on VAT tomorrow. What would that mean?
Well, the difficulty is South African taxpayers and consumers are already overburdened by tax. So a 1% increase in the VAT rate would add about 25 to 30 billion rand to our fiscus. But the cost is borne mostly by the poor South Africans. So folks who already are struggling to make ends meet will pay 1% more on effectively everything they buy, save for a very small basket of goods that are exempt and that we advocate should be expanded as well, that VAT-exempt basket.
You are part of the Government of National Unity. I'm interested to know how much say you've had, if any at all, in contributing to the budget speech or the thinking.
Well, we do have a Deputy Minister of Finance who's actively contributing, and it's been our experience that the Minister of Finance has included him in the decision-making. But it's also the case that Parliament must pass the budget, and we are at a point now where the fiscal situation has deteriorated so badly that we've got 75% debt to GDP, and that practically means that 22 rand out of every 100 that the government is spending at the moment is going towards servicing that high debt burden. So to answer your question perhaps in this way, we are very actively contributing to the conversation, but we are also the responsible adult in the room saying we need to become fiscally responsible, and we don't need to do that by overburdening South African taxpayers more.
The question, of course, is whether the ANC is listening to you.
Well, they must listen to us, and the fact is that they've got 39% of the seats in Parliament. So it is now cooperation territory. And it is our measured response that we'll use our position within the GNU to keep advocating for sensible reforms. Look, we can chat extensively about how the conversation is looking between the minister and deputy ministers, but it's also our position that while we're in the GNU, we've got a voice, and we are adding it to the conversation, and that conversation should focus on structural reforms that is desperately needed in the economy. So in the short term, we will oppose these tax increases. But in the medium to long term, we need to get the economy firing again. And that includes a number of measures that we need to put in place now. We need to concession rail. We need to look at energy reform. We need to look at tariff reform and so on.
All right, let's look at structural reform then. You've raised the issue. You've emphasized unlocking infrastructure development as a cornerstone for economic growth. Are there specific infrastructure projects that your party is prioritizing? And how do you plan to attract private sector participation, given that there is still a degree of skepticism?
Absolutely. I mean, some of the latest surveys indicate a big delta between trust in government and trust in business. So if we are able to establish a framework where folks are able to see government partnering with business, I suspect the trust in those projects will already go up. But practically, you know, we've been asking for a while for a competitive energy market. We want to grant private producers full access to the grid. And then we want to enable market-driven electricity pricing. So that's just on the Eskom side, which, you know, by the way, on the fiscal situation, has contributed almost 500 billion rand in the last 15 years in bailouts, which is an average of more than 30 billion a year. On rail reform, we need to see that ports, including Cape Town, Richards Bay, and Port Elizabeth, are concessioned. And then we need to see private sector participation. I often make this point that at the moment, a lot of South Africa's goods are shipped via a privately owned port in Mozambique. A South African company, Grindrod, runs that port. Mm. And so what's happening here is South African producers and exporters are paying the cost of putting things onto trucks, getting it across the border into Mozambique, traveling through a country in conflict to offload it into a private port because that port is more efficient than our South African ports. I mean, it's ludicrous. So we need to see the private sector participate in, you know, the rail network and in the ports, and the ability for South African producers to compete globally shouldn't also include an excessively high tariff on rail. So these are reforms that we urgently need, and it will get the economy going and it will increase our tax revenue.
Are you able to elaborate for me on specific areas where your party believes spending cuts or reallocation needs to occur in order to achieve something that resembles a balanced budget?
Yep, we are definitely putting all our minds together, in addition to Treasury's many employees that should be looking at this, on what can be cut. I'll just quickly emphasize again that if we get growth right, there's two ways to get debt to GDP down. The one is to, you know, reduce your debt. The other is to increase your GDP. So we want to focus on growing the economy. Because you asked a specific question on what are we doing when we think about spending cuts, one example in the budget is CETAs, which is meant to be these training institutes, but they are so poorly run. They're the subject of multiple SIU investigations. They're mismanaged and they've got qualified audits all over the place. We can actually scrap CETAs by consolidating, and we can do that this week if there was a political will. That's 19 billion rand already that's added to the... Now, we talked earlier about the VAT increase of 1%. If we're able to just do CETAs and then focus a bit on the National Skills Fund, we're already pretty close to a 1% VAT increase by just thinking about which of these holy cows are not that badly needed.
Yeah, I guess the key phrase there, Dr. Burke, is political will. I am going to leave it. Dr. Mark Burke, appreciate your time, the spokesperson on finance for the Democratic Alliance.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now let's move on to tourism, which is often hailed as one of South Africa's greatest economic assets. If my numbers are correct, something like 8% to GDP and employing around 1.5 million people. I suspect it's more though. But despite its potential, the sector continues to struggle with infrastructure challenges, limited government support, and a lack of big strategic investment. So as we head into the budget speech tomorrow, there is a hope that some bold action is going to follow the promises that were made during the State of the Nation. And the big question, will this budget finally give the tourism and hospitality industry the important resources it needs to thrive? Someone at the center of this debate is Alan Campbell, Sales and Marketing Director at Anew Hotels and Resorts, and he joins me on the program now. So, Alan, tourism is repeatedly acknowledged as a key pillar of economic growth. I've been hearing that for decades, yet the industry still faces major barriers. From your perspective, what are the most pressing issues that you hope will be addressed come tomorrow's budget?
I think we want to see a budget that reflects some of the positive sentiment that was laid out in the State of the Nation address. And, you know, recognition of the fact that it's not just a sector, but it is a driver of social upliftment, a creator of jobs and foreign exchange earnings. You know, the key problems we're facing as an industry really are linked to two things: infrastructure. Infrastructure is really falling apart in secondary nodes in rural areas. And this is massively impacting the sector. And instead of a once thriving, you know, natural and cultural attractions, you know, that people can't get to them. And then two, I think our competitiveness within the global market. South Africa should be leading the way on the African continent, but we are falling behind countries like Morocco and Kenya.
So have you applied your mind, Alan, to specific budget allocations or policies that would demonstrate the commitment that government needs to give to support the sector?
I think it's a twofold. I think it's greater engagement with the private sector so that we have greater insight into government's initiatives and can play a role. And two, you know, it's wonderful to see a 940 billion rand infrastructure investment on the cards, but where is that going to play out? You know, how are those going to be dispersed and assigned? And is it really going to address the challenges facing some of our more off-the-beaten-track attractions?
I'm interested that you talk about countries like Kenya and Morocco, which are outpacing South Africa in tourism growth. Are there lessons that we can learn from them in how we need to readjust or recalibrate our approach?
I think certainly. I mean, I think SA Tourism is doing an incredible job. If we look at things like the G20 summit and that spin-off, the other 25 international business events we have lined up between now and 2029, there is a lot of good we're doing. But I think Morocco and Kenya, and to a certain extent Tanzania, are really putting their money where their mouth is, so to speak, when it comes to supporting tourism initiatives and really investing in attracting global clients.
Alan, if I had a rand for every time I was told that tourism is the great great hidden secret as far as South Africa's growth is concerned, I'd probably be able to open my own hotel. I'm just wondering why previous budgets have failed to prioritize tourism at the level it deserves. With respect, the argument you're raising is not new. We've heard this so many times before, haven't we?
I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, we're at, like you rightly mentioned, 8%. I think the latest figure is 8.8% for 2024 of GDP. And we've been in double-digit figures prior to the COVID pandemic. So there is a lot of opportunity within South African tourism, but the budget continues to fail to really give it the recognition and resources it needs to help grow our economy. We face a growing budget deficit, and burdening taxpayers, I don't believe, is the long-term solution to addressing it. I do believe as a country we have everything we need to be able to grow our economy through tourism and foreign currency.
Do you think there's a growing sense of frustration within the tourism and hospitality industry in that respect?
Certainly. I think it's a difficult industry to correctly invest in a bold way without that sort of support or an understanding of how government is going to try and support the tourism industry going forward.
So you mentioned infrastructure a little earlier, and we don't need to list it. Unreliable transport, road maintenance, limited rural connectivity. What kind of prioritization do you think the hospitality industry would need to see in terms of infrastructure investment, which will unlock the growth that you're referring to?
Well, really, to see it deployed in areas that attract global tourists, areas that are, you know, national, I guess, attractions, but are becoming increasingly difficult to access. One only has to look at roads in the Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, Limpopo, and Mpumalanga. And the natural beauty in those areas is, you know, unlike anything you'll find in the world, but getting to them is becoming increasingly difficult.
I don't need to tell you, and this is your area of expertise, that marketing plays a huge role in attracting international tourists, yet our destination marketing budget is stagnant, or at least it appears to be stagnant. Have you applied your mind to what level of investment is needed and where the priority needs to be in terms of focus?
I think that all boils down to what do we see the future percentage of GDP that we want tourism to contribute to our country? Because it is about having a plan for if we see a doubling over the next 10, 20 years, what is the investment required to achieve those goals? I think, you know, at the moment we're paying homage to the fact that it does have the potential, but it is yet really unwilling to unlock that potential with significant investment.
So just a final one then. If the budget fails to deliver on tourism needs, and you've eloquently articulated just how important the sector is, what are the potential long-term consequences for the sector and the economy? Because I'm sensing that we're at something of a nexus point.
It is. I think the 2025 budget must demonstrate bold allocations and address the systemic challenges we've had, but also catalyze new opportunities. We're playing in a global marketplace with global competitors. When we talk about Kenya and Morocco, they're competitors that are doing better. And at the end of the day, if we continue to fall behind, that'll speak for itself.
Well, let's see what emerges in Budget 2025 and the debates that follow. Alan Campbell, thank you very much indeed. Sales and Marketing Director at ANEW Hotels and Resorts.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, as South Africa grapples with energy challenges, many households and businesses have turned to solar power solutions. However, recent action by Eskom has raised concern within the renewable energy community. In December 2024, you might remember, Eskom began visiting customers with grid-tied solar systems, demanding that additional equipment installations and new approvals needed to ensure compliance. And they've warned of hefty fines for non-compliance. So where do we stand on this particular issue? I'm joined now by Karel Balak, who is president of the Association for Renewable Energy Practitioners. Karel, a very warm welcome. So can you provide an overview then of this crackdown on grid-tiered solar system owners? What are the compliance requirements that they're currently enforcing?
Jeremy, there are a couple of things to take a look at. There are different municipalities, and each municipality basically have their own rules that they enforce. There are about 177 different municipalities, and Eskom forms just one of the utilities that have their own rules for connection. Most utilities or municipalities require an electrical COC as a sign-off for the safety of the installation, and then an electrical engineer line diagram that shows that the design meets specific requirements.
So it seems that there are differences in registration requirements. How should users then navigate what are obviously discrepancies here?
I think users need to focus on where their account or their bill comes from, because that is going to define how the registration process is affected. Places like George, for example, you need to have, a couple of months ago, you still needed to have a approved architectural drawing that included the details, which of course has nothing to do with the electrical side of the installation.
So Eskom says that an unregistered grid-tiered solar system is illegal, even if they don't feed electricity back into the grid. That doesn't sound right.
A couple of years ago, NERSA published in the Electrical Regulation Act, Schedule 2 of that act actually makes a requirement for utilities to report back on generation capacity for solar systems in their respective regions. So theoretically, if your system is not registered, it could be deemed to be illegal, but I think of the 177 municipalities, only about 25 of them have the administrative ability to register and capture these systems. So, yeah, I'm not sure exactly how illegal that can be.
In fairness to Eskom, it says that safety and grid stability are the primary reasons for these regulations. Do they have a point?
So through a document called the NRS 097, the NRS 097 limits the sizes of solar PV systems and the rate at which you can charge a battery from the grid. Now, that could definitely have a massive impact on grid stability, as well as maybe the quality of the inverters that are being installed. So I think they do have a point. How inverters are installed, which types of inverters, and the sizes of batteries that are installed could have a massive impact on grid stability.
Carl, explain to me, is this applicable more to businesses that have done this, or households, or a combination of the two?
So theoretically, everybody that has a solar system that is connected to the grid should have their system registered with their respective municipality. You'll find that in most cases, your larger commercial customers have been advised. I would imagine that most of them would have been advised correctly. And for your larger commercial systems, most of those systems, or a large portion of them, would be registered. I think the massive revolt we are seeing on social media is primarily because of smaller systems. But even the smaller systems should be registered.
Now, Carl, costs associated with compliance, I read, are significant. Reports of ranging between 27,000 Rand right up to 50,000 Rand. What factors are contributing to these costs?
I think it really depends, again, comes back to the municipality, and it depends on how thorough your installation has been done. So in some municipalities, you simply require a COC and an engineer sign-off. Up until a couple of months ago, for City Power, for example, an electrician could sign off a system up to, I think if I remember correctly, it was 30 kilowatts. So there you didn't need an engineer final, so that would have a massive impact on the cost for registration. If you were to register through Eskom, that would be about 2,500 rand for the administration fee, and then Eskom will send someone around to come and have a look at the infrastructure. They'll probably change the meter. That would be a couple of thousand rand, 6,000 rand and upwards, depending on whether it's single or three-phase. And then you've got to have all your other compliances in place. Mm. So if you don't have an engineer sign-off, that could easily set you back 4,500 rand for the line diagrams and the sign-off on the engineer side.
And Carl, just a final question to you, and I think it's a fair one. We've got these tough regulatory measures. Are they aligning maybe in spirit with South Africa's broader goals of promoting renewable energy adoption and reducing reliance on the national grid?
Sure, Jeremy, that's a loaded question. Are they aligning? Yeah, I don't know. That's a point we could debate. It's important to have a stable grid. Mm. We've only just had a year of no load shedding, and in most places, a fairly stable grid. I think it's important for future planning to ensure that we know where we're going, and the only way we can do that is to understand how many systems have been installed, and that can only be done through registration. That kind of informs the integrated resource plan, that kind of shows government what we should be planning, how we should ensure power resilience going into the future. So, yeah, I think it has to play a vital role.
And obviously, as you've said as well, the stability of the grid is of paramount importance. I'm going to leave it there. Carl Ballack, thank you very much indeed. He's the president of the Association for Renewable Energy Practitioners. I do appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Okay, let's move on to this. And from AI-powered tools to cloud-based solutions, businesses are under increasing pressure to keep up with rapid technological advancements. And it's coming at us all the time, and it really is a lot for organizations to consider. But in an era of economic uncertainty, should companies be a little more cautious, maybe conservative about all of this tech hype? From Braintree, I'm talking now to Heath Huxtable, who I think is going to explain to us why return on investment should be the first consideration before adopting any new technologies, and that makes perfect sense. Heath, a very warm welcome to you. Before we talk about ROI, maybe just some of the bigger technology trends in 2025 that businesses are rushing to adopt. What are you seeing?
What we're seeing is a fairly significant consolidation of IT spend. What organizations are really looking at is bang for buck. So where they can spend the money, they want to kind of make sure that they're getting a decent return. And that return can be anything from, you know, obviously it's a monetary return. The shareholders are putting pressure on organizations to kind of have a decent return. But also just in terms of, performance, staff performance, the ability to be able to retain staff. We're seeing a big drive towards that consolidation of technologies and around the ability to be able to identify technology that actually makes a significant business impact. And, you know, AI as a starting point has come about, you know, probably in the last 18 to 24 months. A lot of talk around it. And when it first came out, I kept on thinking to myself, I couldn't figure out what the immediate ROI for an organization was. So I spent probably the better part of 6, 7, 8 months trying to get a tangible understanding of exactly what organizations can use to deploy it and how best they can deploy it. The scary part about it was, you know, when we first started out with the discussion, everybody kind of thought, oh my word, okay, it's an opportunity for us to be able to cut headcount. And my first inclination is to say that's probably the worst starting point for a technology discussion in any organization. And, I think the benefit of kind of where we go to technology now is about enabling people, getting people to do what they do better and far more effectively than they did in the past. It's not a replacement of people. It's actually just an enhancement of an individual's individual's tool sets to be able to deliver a set outcome.
Right. Heath, let me circle back to the ROI debate, if I can. I absolutely understand it, given that so many organizations are facing huge margin pressure right now. But surely continuity, efficiency, and stability is just as important, even if it's a bit more expensive.
Very, very, very much so, Jeremy. And I think that to me, almost every single technology that comes about like this, in various decades, comes about as a disruptive force. And almost every single time this disruptive force comes about, it's about looking at people continuity. I mean, our organization, we're about people, and for me, the single most important thing is about, you know, maintaining the ability for an organization to kind of retain key staff, not disrupt that sort of part of the business, but to be able to use the technology to kind of unleash the opportunities that people have. AI is a disruptor 100%. Should it disrupt it to the point where it affects business continuity? Absolutely not. And that, I think, is the secret sauce, is that when you're engaging with a consulting company around being able to deploy certain technologies like this, what you want to be able to do is ensure that it drives the right outcome. Competitive advantage is one of those things. Efficiency is another. If there's a cost saving element in it, obviously. But I think the big thing is just to be able to kind of maintain business. It's business as usual, but to unlock more value.
Interestingly, you also suggest, and to that end, putting people in the middle of the equation. Personality profiling is important when implementing new technology. I get inherently nervous when I hear that phrase.
We're an organization, Jeremy, of 160-odd people. And there are 160 unique individuals. Each of them have their strengths. Everyone has inherent weaknesses. Our ability, we change and we pivot as we go along because we're learning constantly. But I think one of the things that we're trying to do is to make sure that when you put people on a project, for example, that you put people that can work together. You know, you don't want a brace of individuals working together with somebody that can't necessarily work like that. Mm. You want certain people that are outcomes based versus, you know, softer skills based. And what we've done is we've invested quite heavily in programs to kind of identify what the individual strengths of people are, And when we kind of put a project team together or assemble a team together for an implementation with a defined outcome, we match the outcome with the people that we put in, make sure that the people we put in actually achieve the output that we expect in. So it's a constant investment process and it's a constant learning process for us. But understanding people's strengths and personalities is absolutely key in everything. And that goes to understanding what the customer engagement looks like as well. Is we get certain customers that really just tend to view organizations like ours as a service provider, and we get some that tend to look at us as partners, you know, in a solution. And depending on that engagement, it also changes the way in which we kind of view and engage in every single project. So it's a very fluid kind of process, and it's something that we keep on learning, you know, with every single implementation, every single customer right. we sign on, every new employee that we bring on.
So lots of valuable lessons there. Heath Huxtable, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time today from Braintree. And that's our program for today. We are back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South African business, political and social environments. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.